Hello, we're Class War Games.
I'm Fabian Thompson.
I'm Richard Barbrook.
And yes, we're here. Actually, we're pre-recording this, we have to say. So we're going to be a little bit limited on our news because we're actually backwards in time compared to you listening to this now.
It's the wonders of pre-recording is you can time travel.
Yes, and it's the wonders of having summer holiday breaks where they shut the studio for a couple of weeks.
Oh, they should be all hard at work all the time at Resonance FM. We don't think Sarah should ever get any time off. Okay, so by the time this goes out, we'll have actually had another go at public testing of the Uprising game.
Yes, that's all going very well, actually.
Yesterday will have been club night at the Flea Pit.
Yep.
And that went very well, I assume.
Well, yes, it did, actually.
It was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I'm glad to see so many people turned up.
Yes. And so we're going to have another club night in the 8th of September. Sorry, the 7th of September. No, the 8th of September.
8th of September, yes.
Tuesday, 8th of September at the Flea Pit in Columbia Road.
Yes. What we're actually doing is we're breaking our two-week cycle on account of the Notting Hill Carnival.
Yes, after 2 days dancing on the streets, I will be in no condition to go anywhere on that duty.
Are you guys off for a boogie?
Oh, I was going to KCC, Happy House and Garage, you know. You'll see me there.
Yeah. Blowing your whistles.
Oh, yes. Don't worry. And other things.
Yes.
So we're going to be doing that on Tuesday, 8th of September. That'll be our last one before the great HTTP Class War Games Festival on the 26th, 27th of September.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, if you can make it down there, it's up in Haringey.
Yeah.
We're going to have the new film will be out there, the world premiere of the new film. And then we've got our Marcel Duchamp meets Blue Peter.
Yes, making games of war.
Yes, and so it's like on both days of the weekend. And yeah, come down. I mean, it will be a laugh, and it'll be entertaining and informative.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go now to an interview with Sean from Leisure Games. Leisure Games is, if for those of you who don't know, is up in Finchley, 100 Ballard's Lane, and it's the best board game shop in London.
Yes. I mean, I haven't been there yet, but I have.
I've made a few pilgrimages there. Some of the games that we've been reviewing on this show were actually got there.
Yes. And I mean, I think, you know, you see things like Games Workshop sort of dotted around the place. That's really the kind of McDonald's of gaming.
And this is the Cordon Bleu.
Yes.
And it doesn't just have board games. It has all sorts of stuff. And especially of interest to Fabian, which is why he should go there, is it's got lots of different varieties of dice.
Yes.
So it has average dice and extreme dice and percentage dice and duodecimal dice.
Oh, the combinations are so vast.
So he's definitely going to go. Now we'll send him in our little break. I think I should send him up there to pay his pilgrimage.
I will.
Okay, so we're going to go over to Sean now. I hope you're on the line.
I am, yes.
Okay, so we're going to start off about the shop itself. You know, why was the shop founded?
Right, the shop was founded by Tony, the father of the current manager, Mike, in August 1985. And Tony and his business partner used to be in the shoe business. And they'd moved on from that, and Tony was looking for a new business. And There was a model shop up nearby in Finchley, which was closing down, and the chap knew Tony, and he said, "Well, look, there's a bit of a gap in the market there, and why don't you have a go at filling that?" So Tony started up Leisure Games.
Wow!
So was he a gamer himself already?
He wasn't at the time. No, he plays bowls and stuff, but not a board gamer at the time. I mean, he is now. He's president of the Finchley Games Club now, for life, I think. He wasn't at the time, no, but he came into it purely as a business thing. And
it's been successful.
It grew from there.
So there's one question I'm dying to ask. Yeah. Have you ever had Maggie Thatcher come in as a customer?
Not while I've been in.
Okay.
I've had a few people whose personality I might compare to hers, but certainly not the woman herself.
Well, they were buying the Let's Invade Russia games, were they?
I wonder. I can't remember. I she's not been in here, no. I think if she did, she might get a frosty reception, certainly from about 50% of the staff.
OK, then. Well, can you say a bit more about the sort of people who do come to your shop to buy games?
Yeah, there's a huge range of people. I mean, you know, right now we've got people browsing sort of family war games, family games, you know, your Monopoly and the Scrabble and stuff. We get quite a lot of people who are just in for that kind of thing. We have people who come from all over the world. There are people who, you know, make trips over here especially to come and visit our shop because it's the only place in this country where you can see this kind of collection of games, apart from a few people's personal collections,
right.
On the shelves, where you're able to pick them up and, you know, physically look at the products. So, and we get people who've travelled from all over the place to come here. We have, you know, children buying Yu-Gi-Oh cards. We even have a handful of World War II veterans picking up war games, usually by mail order. But yeah.
So it's not just geeky teenage boys then?
No. I mean, the role-playing section is probably I don't want to be unfair on the role-playing section, but that particular stereotype is probably more the people who buy role-playing games. So, no, not all geeky, certainly, no. Lots of very interesting and quite ordinary people.
Oh, good. So, I mean, when I was up there, I did notice it had an amazingly large number of women actually sort of looking at the products, rather, which was quite surprising given our experience of going to war game shows.
Yes, we even have women staff now as well. So it's quite
aggressive.
We're diversifying. Yeah, we there are lots of female gamers, and we have some in the shop right now.
So, what's your best-selling board game?
It's over a period of time. I would say in board games, Settlers of Catan has sold a huge number of copies. I think it's something like 8 million copies or something worldwide. Not with us, obviously. It'd be nice if it had.
Otherwise, Tony would be retiring to the Bahamas.
Yes, I think so. So,
could you describe for the listeners what this game's about?
It's very much based around trading. There is a board which is a randomly set up board made of hexes, and it's different every time you play it. And what you're doing is spending resource cards to build settlements and roads between them. But the resources that you will be looking for change throughout the course of the game, depending how far you've progressed. And the main gameplay is in the trading across the table between players who are just literally bargaining with one another. I'll give you 3 sheep for 1 wood or something like that. So you're constantly trying to make deals with people, and
so it's sort of training for a job in the City of London, is it? Commodity exchanges.
Yeah. That's a very enjoyable part of the game. It's very sort of social like that. There's very little downtime.
And what other games have been successful recently?
More recently, Ticket to Ride has picked up steam, if you can excuse the pun. That's been doing very well, and that's
What sort of game is that about?
Well, we tend to call that, it falls into the category they call gateway games, which in complexity are quite easy to push towards people who usually only play family board games. And it plays in about half an hour to 40 minutes, and there are various different versions of it with different maps. The standard one is a map of America, and it'll have lots of stations all over it and various tracks of different colours. Which you will be attempting to join together with trains of your particular colour to join destinations which could be quite close together or far apart across the board.
So it's a bit like a development of the games from the sort of 70s and 80s, like 1820, where you built the railway network, is it?
It's a sort of more simple, family-friendly kind of take on that kind of thing. because it's very fast playing. Your turn comes around again very quickly, because on your turn you either take some resource cards, which you will save up to be able to spend to lay track down later, or you lay track. And that's the principal choice you're making through the game. It's how long do I want to hold off before I reveal what my destinations might be,
etc. Right. And so are any of the war games very popular, or is this a sort of very much a subgenre of these sort of economic type games?
There are some very popular war games. If I just wander over to the shelf now, actually, to remind myself some of the titles, because I'm not actually a war gamer myself. I mean, the ASL range always does very well, and GMT, their stuff does. Oh, Command and Colours from GMT,
yeah.
That's done very well. That's it uses a similar system to Memoir 44. And a game, an old Civil War game, I believe, is called Battle Cry, and Battle Lore by Days of Wonder, and there are quite a few expansions for that, and it's that's done very well. Yeah, it's a relatively non-complex combat system.
Okay, I mean, we live in an age when computer games have really taken off.
Mm.
But the board game still has its own particular nature. Like it's to do with people facing each other rather than facing computer screens.
Yeah, the social aspect is very different, isn't it?
Yeah, so
I think we always found that's one of the reasons why the people who were very involved in new media, that's why we went back to analog gaming.
Yes. What I'd like to ask is, what are the new trends in board game design as you see in your shop?
Recently, I mean, last year there was a lot of, there were quite a few cooperative games, some of which might have one player who was opposing player or none at all, and everybody was just working together. Things like Pandemic or Ghost Stories, which were both quite popular last year.
But is Pandemic selling well during swine flu times?
Well, yeah, it has sold a few. There's been no great boom or dip in its popularity, and there's an upcoming expansion for it, so I'm sure there'll be a little...
HN1, yes.
I'm not sure if it'll be that. If it were me, I'd probably try and make a crude cash in on it. No, I wouldn't at all.
No.
But in the last year, there's been a bit of a trend for games that are quite reminiscent of CCGs, collectible card games.
Uh-huh.
And those would be things like Race for the Galaxy, Agricola, and Dominion, which has been absolutely huge.
So what's Dominion? Could you just describe that for our listeners?
Yeah, it's entirely a card-based game. And you start with a very small number of cards, and during the game you'll be taking cards off of various different piles of different types of cards with the intention of building your deck. You're sort of building a little machine in your hand that will enable you to get victory points. And there are different ways that you can do that, lots and lots and lots of different ways. So it kind of makes the process of deck building that a lot of CCG players are very familiar with, and there's a huge amount of the enjoyment in CCGs.
Can you just
play itself?
This is he's getting problems with your anagram there.
Yeah, CCGs.
Sorry?
Something card games.
Collectible card games.
Ah, right.
CCGs, right. Sorry.
So you're so immersed in the business of selling games.
You're getting absorbed into alphabet soup.
Yeah, things like Yu-Gi-Oh is one that's very common. Magic the Gathering will be the best known one.
Uh-huh.
So games where you assemble your own set of cards rather than using fixed sets.
Right, okay. Right. And so just to sort of conclude, I mean, we're going to encourage our listeners to go up and visit you. And, being Resonance FM, they are, shall we say, slightly left of centre. What sort of games would you recommend for them to come in? When they come in and they want to buy a game and they want to have something a little bit political, subversive, what would you recommend for them?
It's a tricky question, one that we all sort of put our heads together over this morning. And thematically, we just sort of came up with some cliched sort of Cold War type answers. So there are things like Twilight Struggle, which is one of GMT's most popular war games. That would be one option.
Can you fight both the evil empires in that? Or do you have to choose one side or the other?
I'm pretty sure it's a two-player game, so yes, you would have to make a choice. What else was there? There's a game from a card game called Cold War, which is a CIA versus KGB, some Fantasy Flight.
Oh, I can see how that could work.
We were sort of thinking that some of the cooperative games, regardless of their theme, might also be appealing, just due to the fact that the game mechanism itself is sort of about, you know, working together and cooperating rather than it being
search and destroy.
Yeah,
I mean, that was one of the interesting things we found out about the War on Terror, is that rather than people dropping out of the game, they all stuck to cooperate against the person who is threatening to become the winner.
Yeah, as the terrorists, I think that's pretty subversive.
Yeah. And then they so what happens is that the person left might not actually win if the others cooperate sufficiently against them.
There's quite a few where that can occur, yeah.
So which ones in particular did you think our listeners might enjoy?
The ones I said there sort of thematically. In terms of cooperative games, there's been Battlestar Galactica, which... Mm-hmm.
That's in the new TV series, I assume.
Yes, yeah. That's apparently a fantastic game. I've not played it. Ghost Stories I played a lot of. That is extremely... You can play it solo, but it is extremely cooperative, up to four players. Yeah. It's pretty much a puzzle solving, you know, a long term sort of planning and puzzle solving game, which but the theme is Chinese ghost stories. I think Pandemic is an obvious.
Okay, well, I think we should try Pandemic.
I think, yes.
Yeah.
The HNV1 game of the year. right, well, thank you very much, Sean, for your time.
To have you on.
Yeah, that was great. So that's Sean from Leisure Games. They're at 100 Ballard's Lane. Finchley Central is the nearest tube. Do go out there. It's a great shop. I highly recommend it. And we're going to send Fabian up there too.
Yes, I'll be out there for a copy of Pandemic in a little while.
Little chat as well. Because that's the other thing about these shops. I think as opposed to buying things online, you can go and chat to the staff like Sean. Yep. So go and say hello if you pop in. And thanks a lot again. Thanks so long, Sean.
Yep, cheers.
And also they have a website, www.leisuregames.com. Okay, thanks. Well, we're now going to move on to our weekly review.
Yeah.
Which is a game called War and Peace, an Avalon Hill game produced in 1980.
And it can be as long as the book.
It could be longer, I think, actually. This is quite an interesting game. I mean, both me and Fabian are of a certain age where when we were teenagers, we played a lot of these hex-based games. We've talked about this in the past.
Particularly Avalon and Hill.
And SPI.
Yeah. And the SPI became a little bit more technical than Avalon and Hill. Avalon Hill were always a bit like more mainstream than SBI, but it's nothing to do with Glastonbury, funnily enough.
No, exactly. It's to do with creating a sort of family-friendly war game, but this one is definitely not. This is one of their things which they obviously decided that they were going to do a complicated game.
If you've got, you know, teenage geek sons and you want to keep them out of trouble
for 3 weeks.
Yes, make sure they don't start, you know, tampering with the American computers to check out UFOs and that sort of stuff. Then this game could be very useful.
Do you recommend it for our more autistic listeners?
Well, yes.
So what it is, it's a suite of games based around the Napoleonic Wars.
Yes, it's actually called the Avalon and Hill, they put a little strap on it. It's the Avalon and Hill.
Avalon
Hill. Game of Napoleonic strategy.
Wars.
So they're quite pompous in the way they market their stuff, and this was their kind of definitive, this is what Napoleon was about. This is our take on Napoleon, and they put it all into the game, and then they have the different scenarios of the different campaigns.
And so you can play the rise and fall of the Bonaparte's empire, basically. You can go and beat the Austrians, beat the Prussians, try and conquer Spain, or invade Russia.
And come back with your tail between your legs.
And then, yes, exactly. And then try and hold your empire together as everybody gangs up to you. And then finally try and come back and win at Waterloo.
Yeah.
So it does, but it also is set up so you could play not as a series of separate campaigns, but as one giant war. With multiplayer.
Exactly. That's for the summer holidays, I think, when you want to keep the youth off the streets.
Particularly if you were stuck in a British summer where it rained all the time.
Well, yes.
So those for those stay-a-thon holidays, you can use this to keep the kids and the adults busy.
Yes.
So we tried this game out, or did you try this game out?
Well, my problem was, when I tried it out, I thought, this is a bit like doing my accounts. So actually doing my accounts is a bit more interesting. And I feel so happy when my accounts are finished that I decided to do my accounts.
Or is it just because you're becoming short-sighted? And you know, when you're a teenager, you could actually see the pieces very clearly and didn't have to study them very hard.
Well, that was another aspect of it all. But also what it brought back to me is I went through a time of playing quite a lot of Avalon Hill games. And when I started to try and play this, I realised why I'd stopped playing these games. And that was one aspect, that now I have to, like, peer at the pieces, where before I had pretty good sight as a youth, so I could, like, spot the details of the most, you know, insignificant unit. Oh, yeah, well, that's the recon unit, yeah. Or whatever, right? But I mean, yes, I've become a little bit impatient as I've become a crotchety middle-aged man.
It's also a thing that maybe this is a thing that things like these computer games that use Command and Conquest to actually as their sort of engine, they started to do Napoleonic games. So maybe this is a game that maybe would work better really as a computer game to allow you to take a lot of this calculation out of it.
Yes, in fact, I can remember sometime in the 80s, I thought, why am I playing these games? All I've got to do is wait for 20 years and they'll all be on computer games.
But the problem,
which I then did.
But the problem is, of course, you don't have the board and the pieces. So there is an advantage in having the whole of Europe laid out on a board and moving your pieces across it.
Yeah, that's quite fun.
Like a lot of Avalon Hill games, you know, you do end up with large stacks of pieces which you then have to move off the board and remember which general is commanding which stack of pieces because it's on a little separate piece of paper with their names of all the generals.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, as I say, it took me back to something that I'd stopped doing.
Well, I did try playing this game because I just read a Karl von Clausewitz, the famous Prussian military theorist, and he wrote some sort of memoir, basically, because of the campaign of 1812. This is when Bonaparte tried to invade Russia. The Prussians were actually allied with the French at this point, but Clausewitz decided that he much preferred going to fight for the Russians, and him and a group of sort of, who were the sort of radicals in the Prussian military all went to Russia. And it's a sort of memoir of his involvement in the campaign. So I tried playing the 1812 scenario in here.
Right. Were you listening to Tchaikovsky at the same time?
Oh, probably drum and bass, actually,
oh,
mate.
Right.
Much better rhythm section. It's interesting because we talked about the game of war a lot in this, and it way that in De Boer's game you have the supply lines in mm-hmm. it, and this game does have this in it. It has you have to actually like a lot of you have to have a supply base, and as the French advance into Russia, they have to sort of leave troops behind to create a supply network. Which obviously, if you're the Russians, you have these Cossack pieces that you try and cut the supply line out, like they did historically. You also get this sort of attrition as the pieces move forward. Every go, you have to throw a dice to see how many people get sick or decide they've had enough of war and want to go home. So the French start off with a very large army and they do get some reinforcements. But basically, the further they get into Russia, the Grand Army shrinks to becoming a small army.
Right, and does it have zones of control? Because that's what I remember from these games.
It has all those sorts of things.
Just to explain, a zone of control is the idea was that you'd have like a map composed of hexagons. And the reason for putting hexagons is that the distance from the centre of all the adjacent places is equal. Whereas if you have a square grid, it's actually further on the diagonals than it is on the orthogonals. So then this became part of the orthodoxy of hexagons is much more mathematically pure and everything like that.
Well, also it was invented by the Rand Corporation in the 1950s for the American military planning.
Yeah.
So it had this sort of pseudo-scientific gloss to it.
Exactly. And then the idea was that if you put a unit in a space, that the enemy could not travel through an adjacent space. They would have to stop as soon as they moved into it. They couldn't continue through.
Well, I think they do have things like this in it. And they also, because of these attrition rules, they do make it a bit like Napoleonic warfare, that you can't have, like, one big army. You have to split it, like Bonaparte did, into a number of corps and then come together for a decisive battle.
They had something like that in The Unhappy Charles.
Yes, which we are going to talk about in a forthcoming show. This is a wonderful English Revolution game that we're playing at the moment. So you get this decisive battle, but this is the problem with the game. You can spend 2 or 3 hours, you know, manoeuvring all your troops across the board and going through all these complicated rules, and then you have the decisive battle, where basically a few dice throws will decide the whole game. So if Bonaparte throws a couple of sixes, he wins, and if, you know, Kutuzov throws a couple of sixes, he wins. And so that's, I think, is the problem with the game.
Would it be helpful if you used average dice?
Or extreme dice would be even more fun. I was interested because you look at Clausewitz's book. I mean, he basically says it's impossible for Bonaparte to win because once he decided to go all the way to Moscow and take the capital, what he thought was the capital city of Russia. I'm not sure why he thought that, because St. Petersburg was then the capital city of Russia. But he had this belief that once you seized Vienna, you had the Austrian Empire. Once you seized Berlin, you defeated the Kingdom of Prussia. And so he operated on the same principle when he invaded Russia and saying, well, if I take Moscow, I will win, because then the Tsar will be forced to negotiate with me. And basically they called his bluff and said, well, we're a peasant country and you burn our capital city down, doesn't, who cares? We're just going to retreat further. Bit like what Hitler discovered as well. The Russians are very good at retreating until they've worn out the enemy and then countered. So his art, so this game actually is very difficult because they actually have to have victory conditions.
Right.
It's a bit like some of the games up in the wonderful Leisure Games Shop, where again you have the Hitler invading Russia, where they have to make it possible for the Nazis to win when it's sort of impossible.
Or what you do is you have a balance where if they don't lose too badly, that counts as a win.
Yeah, so they have this. They have these scenarios where you can, Bonaparte can win. And I tried invading Moscow and lost, and then I just seized St. Petersburg and won. But that was basically the game itself. And so I found that a bit problematic. So it's a question of whether you want a game that's realistic, it's recreating the historical dilemmas of the time, or it's actually just a game where two sides can have fun playing with each other. And I think it sort of, one hand, it tries to be too realistic. So it's very fiddly, it's got too many rules. And it's complicated to play. But also, on the other hand, it doesn't actually seem, particularly in this scenario I played, about actually the gaming itself is a bit boring.
Yes, and I mean, what you also touched on there is the whole thing about the pseudoscience, the RAND Corporation. It's the idea to what extent the game is educational. It will teach you about the historic encounter and to what extent it's meant to be fun. Yeah. And then so often you get different scenarios. You get the real scenario where actually they're going to lose this, whichever side lost. That, you know, there's no way out. And then they say, but we've got this other scenario where we've balanced it by, and then usually they invent some like historical quirk which allows the losing side to have some possibility of winning.
So, yes, I haven't tried the other scenarios. It would be interesting to try. Maybe I could offload it on you again. You could try some of the other scenarios.
Peninsular War, maybe.
Yes. Though I think if you want to play a Napoleonic Wars game, we would recommend Napoleon's Triumph, actually, the Austerlitz game. Where,
But one thing with this game, because something that I just recalled now, is that some people use this and then would use their figurines to actually fight the battles.
Oh, that would maybe be better.
Yeah, so they would do the strategy on the board game and then the actual confrontation with figurines.
That might make more sense, but you'd have to have a large table with it set up all the time, so that would be the downside.
Well, people that dedicated know exactly how to do all these things.
Okay, well, thank you for listening. We're Class War Games.
Yeah.
And we will listen, you can hear us next week.
Yes, next week at 5 o'clock. We'll be recording the programme a little bit later this afternoon. So,
But you will still hear it.
You'll have to wait a week to hear it.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.